So, Lucinda Cummings Kilmer has come all the way from Texas with her husband, Wesley. Lucinda was research assistant to Norman Sherry, who wrote three volumes on Graham Greene. I think it took him about 20 years. It's a monumental achievement. I'm conscious the responses to Sherry are quite polarized, but nevertheless, that he has served to really seal Greene's reputation in the popular imagination. And if you haven't read his books, I really suggest you get into them, because they're not only a great way of coming to grips with Greene's life, but also his works. There is a great deal in there that is the result of painstaking research. So Lucinda came to the festival with Norman Sherry in 2000 and 2004. We're delighted she's returned to us. She has been based with Sherry at Trinity University, San Antonio, Texas. Sherry, of course, passed, I think, 2 years ago. And she's presently writing a book about Norman Sherry, which we look forward to seeing when it comes out eventually. I believe you're in the process of that. So welcome back again. Can I hand the stage over to you? Thank you.
Good morning. I'm grateful to be here today. I know every festival speaker on every stage says I'm privileged to be here and delighted to be here. And I say it too, but I really mean it. The last time I was here, I was sitting where you are, wondering what in the world the person in front of me was going to say. But we're about to find out. Before I begin in earnest, I just had a few things I wanted to share. I would like to pay homage to a good friend of this festival, greatly loved and sorely missed, and I'm speaking of dear David Pierce. David and I became pen pals 19 years ago, and we corresponded all the way through his last bike trek. David kept the lower lights burning for my boss during those troubled waters of Volume 3, and he was a great encouragement to me, too. In 2000, when David and I said goodbye, I thanked him for the hospitality of his lovely wife, Liz, and Roger Watkins, and Jan Christensen, and John Davison, and so many people in Berkhamsted who had been so kind to my boss. And I mentioned to David the beautiful church bells I had heard ringing that morning. And I said, they were achingly beautiful. And David said, yes, aren't they though? And it was I who was ringing them. So whenever I hear church bells, even today, I think of David. I'm sure you've noticed my Texas accent. If I had another one, I would use that one. But if you need me to say something, repeat it, just give me a little wave and I'll try to do better. I will, however, try to enunciate as I was taught in vocal diction for choristers, if I remember that course. I admit here and now that the closest I ever came to meeting Graham Greene was when I dropped a very rushed Norman off at the office so that he could rush back to his desk and take a scheduled phone call from Graham. But if Graham did indeed telephone, I missed it, because by the time I got back from the far-flung faculty car park, Norman was already back in class lecturing. So I missed my chance, but I do say I shook the hand that shook the hand, and that was my brush with greatness. But I know that Norman treasured his golden moments with Graham. Norman would describe himself as a little less than friend, but a little more than biographer, and their relationship was real. So, speaking of golden moments, I'm just going to ask you to indulge me very quickly here. I never met Graham, but I did have a chance to become a name dropper through Norman's work for Graham. And I always resist to do this because it's so rude and nobody really believes me. But if I ever had a chance and a crowd, I could do it and they might believe me. This is it. So, through Norman, I got to meet actors Ray Fiennes and Nanette Newman, film critic Philip French and film writer Neil Sinyard, academics Harold Bloom, John Carey, Cedric Watts, Jacques Barzun, novelists Peter Carey, John Updike, Stephen Wiesensee, John Mortimer, and superstar biographers Hilary Sperling and Michael Holroyd, directors Brian Forbes and Neil Jordan, and Green family members Graham Carlton Green and James Green. I spoke to Gore Vidal on the telephone and corresponded with William Manchester and John Irving, and so many American authors, all the American authors who were preeminent in the 80s and 90s. But what do all these folks have in common with us today? They all admired the work of Graham Greene. And then lastly, I'll just say before I really jump in, I know I'm among scholars here and experts on Graham Greene, and it's a very humbling position because I am neither scholar nor expert. However, as has been said here, I am the expert on an expert of Graham Greene. Norman Sherry was Graham Greene's authorized biographer. It was a role he relished. He took it on with great devotion to the man he called a titan of 20th century literature. To understand Norman's trilogy on Graham, I'd like to take a few minutes to share some of Norman's thoughts on biography as a genre. Norman saw biography as more than a litany of life events. In 1991, while he was addressing the Southeast Asia Writers Award in Bangkok, Norman said that biography brought back all sorts of people into existence who would otherwise have been forgotten. Norman took great satisfaction in this type of resurrection. Critic Tony Tanner pointed out that Norman's very first biography on Joseph Conrad, Conrad's Eastern World, revealed the genius of Conrad's imagination. That's what Norman was after. He wanted to know more than just the demographics of a person. The who, what, when, where, and how, and even the why, were not enough for Norman. He went after deeper revelation. And the truth is, if it weren't for Conrad, there would have been no Green-Sherry collaboration. The groundwork for his Graham Greene biographies was laid during Norman's research on Conrad at the University of Singapore, where he went in 1965. He was teaching there and finishing his PhD, and all the while reading newspaper articles from the Straits Times about Joseph Conrad's life there. Norman's unflappable patience in this crazy type of research was going to serve him well for Graham Greene work. Most biographers endeavor to walk in the footsteps of their subjects. Richard Holmes did that with Coleridge. Michael Holroyd did it with Stracey and Shaw. But Norman was a master subrogator, nearly in the literal Latin sense of that term. He put himself in another's shoes and retraced their footsteps. There's a Native American Indian proverb about not judging another man until you've walked a mile in his moccasins, and Norman loved that quote because it affirmed his way of doing business. And remember, Graham Greene implored Norman to do this. He made him promise he would follow in his footsteps. And this type of research drove Norman. He would slink to the depths of that university library in the newspaper morgue to read about Joseph Conrad. And there was an ever-present library attendant there. And every time Norman passed him, that attendant would say, "Oh, Professor Sherry, I feel very, very sorry for you." But Norman kept on, and he stayed in the newspaper morgue for thousands of articles. Norman said there were many times he wanted to skip a day or stop and take a break, but he said, "I pressed on, quote, just to prove the little bastard wrong," unquote. But Norman was nothing if not intrepid, and his Conrad Eastern World caught Tony Tanner's eye,
and Graham named it Book of the Year in 1966. Norman couldn't know then, but the stars were aligning for his future Green work, because Graham Greene loved Joseph Conrad too. Conrad's Western rule followed in 1971, after which Norman spent years lecturing and writing as a, if not the, ranking Conrad scholar, and he was head of the Conrad Society and the editor of Conradiana. So he enjoyed those years, but things started to change when Norman and his first wife Sylvia left Singapore so that he could go to Liverpool. He said farewell to his Singapore university colleagues nicely and hail fellow, well met, bye, good luck. But in the cab on the way to the airport, Sylvia, who spoke enough Mandarin to get by, disabused Norman of his impression that the library attendant wished him well, because she said, "You might have thought he said goodbye and good luck, but what he said was, 'Good riddance, you red-headed demon.'" So, Graham has said, "There is always one moment in childhood when the door opens and lets the future in." For Norman, this pivotal opening happened a little bit later than childhood, but Singapore was nonetheless his portal for Green. What started as a mysterious lunch with a friend of a friend who spoke in riddles, alluding to someone famous who admired his Conrad biographies, ended with Norman and Graham getting together at the Savile Club on Brook Street in London in 1974. The Savile was Norman's club, whose former and current members included Ralph Richardson, Winston Graham, William Golding, Henry James, Rudyard Kipling, A.A. Milne, Robert Louis Stevenson, H.G. Wells. It was a heady group, and Graham, who described himself as the most unclubbable man ever, agreed to meet Norman there, and it was fitting to have this grand backdrop for a strange blind date. Norman arrived early, and at the appointed hour, Graham's face peered around the corner of the blue, what was then the blue and white billiard room. And they sat and they chatted about men and women and dictators and disease and conflicts and travel and writing, and it was all small talk. Since Norman had the gift for conversation, I'm certain he had a higher word count than Graham did, but no deal was offered or accepted as they were sitting in the parlor. So when they ran out of the small talk, they went for a stroll. Well, Graham took one long stride for every two of Norman's little ones, and so it became a bit of a race. And then it started to rain. And while crossing the street in a mizzling rain, as Norman would say, a taxi cab skidded a little bit, and in getting out of the way, Graham stumbled a bit and fell down on the pavement. And while getting up and brushing himself off, he looked at Norman and said, "Well, you almost lost your subject." And so the ensuing arrangement came down to a handshake, back in the day when an oral agreement and a handshake between gentlemen was as good as a written contract. So it had begun. The Conrad-inspired collaboration of Graham and Norman, the wily old fox and the audacious hound, was on. And this went on for 17 years. Graham never volunteered anything, but Norman asked much anyway. Norman loved the chase, for Norman's creed was, "The facts of a person's life will, like murder, come out." The title of my talk, The Fox and the Hound, is anthropomorphic in the reverse. The fox, because Norman actually called the clever and wily Graham this in volume 3, section, a masterpiece from the old fox. And the hound, because Norman had a nose for information. He could track a jackrabbit down a tunnel in a monsoon. He never lost the scent. Michael Holroyd has described biography as a posthumous work of collaboration with a subject who's no longer above ground. But for Norman, Graham was alive and kicking for the first two volumes, and not quite the publication of the second volume, but for all of the research of the second volume. So this kind of collaboration was dicey for Norman and quite different from Conrad, who'd been dead for 50 years before Norman ever tackled him. So Norman set out to pursue Graham, and Graham kept up a benign recalcitrance for 17 years. Biography cannot contain any fiction. The temptation to spice things up was completely resistible for Norman because Graham's life was exciting as any fiction. And the New York Times has said that Graham's fiction was his fact, and Graham lived a life that deserved to be told. Norman had yearned to write detective fiction after he retired. He never quite got there. But since Graham's life was so full of dramatic and dynamic twists and turns, just like a thriller or a mystery, Norman took to it naturally. It was a privilege for me to observe Norman's creative process. I wanted to learn how to write from working for him. And I think I did learn how to write. But I also learned how not to write. And the most important thing I learned from him was how to rewrite. And did we ever? That is the most valuable. Norman's mantra was, let's write a good book. But it had a subtext. It has to be right to be good. Norman was thorough to a fault. I saw him read two thick history books just to get an end note about Haiti and the comedians, right? He was, as he said, preternaturally aware of Graham's peeking over his shoulder. Graham's advice to Norman on his Boswell's presumptuous task was, and everybody here has heard it, tell the truth. If it's for me, all well and good. If it's against me, so be it. The truth, Norman, else I'll haunt you. And the memory of Graham's blue eyes bore into him. Norman took it deadly seriously. Graham's words echoed, and towards the end of volume three, with Graham long departed, Norman did indeed feel haunted. I'm not sure if he thought it was Graham who was after him, but he was definitely hounded in that home stretch. Norman finished writing volume three on the morning of September 11th, 2001. Events of that day overtook the joy of finishing. But even so, it wasn't truly finished. There were years of editing ahead. Just before that September finale of the trilogy, I arrived at Norman's home office one morning and caught him standing at his desk, head down, fists clenched on the table's edge, and his keyboard upside down, drying out, having had a beer spilled out on it the night before. Norman was thoroughly miserable, and his electric power was out because of an early morning storm that had moved through South Texas. To my intense sympathy and encouragement, he responded without even looking up, and he said, "It's the devil I work for." I had to agree, the devil indeed. But nonetheless, Norman pressed on. A prominent American biographer has said of the craft, biographers generally start with the person. Historians generally start with the conditions by which their subject is constrained. Norman certainly embraced both the person and history. And Norman was not afraid of details, as anyone who read volume one may remember, because we're told when Graham got his first tooth, how many plush animals he took to bed with him in the nursery at night, and why, the name of the concierge at the Mexican hotel in 1938. But if God is in the details, then that aforementioned devil seemed to be too, because as is evident in this letter, full of what Norman called Graham's chicken scratchings, the details were key to the truth. But Dry details never deterred Norman from orchestrating all of that into the story. I used to tell Norman, I don't think you could have ever written a biography of a scientist or a mathematician, because Norman was after the inspiration of creativity, and I don't think Euclid had a muse. Green's characters are so vividly drawn that we feel as if we know these people, or at least we surely want to, or we surely don't. That's how well we think we know the characters. Graham gave care to endear or repel us, not to just the main character, but not just to the whiskey priest or Holly Martins, but all the characters around them, the peripheral people, because Graham knew what it was like to be minimized as a child, and he had great sympathy for people who were powerless or constrained, or just like the little boy in the fallen idol, or the mestizo in The Power and the Glory, so hated by everyone. Graham's hurt shaped his worldview. He carried it always. And Norman had a great insight to those who are marginalized, as he himself was the unexpected twin born almost unattended after his elder brother, older by 15 minutes, entered the world to a tiny, middle-aged English Anglican woman and a tall, tubercular Catholic Irish father with a fierce temper and a love of port, and who was not against lashing out verbally and with a switch at the precocious but good-natured and sweet young Norman. So Norman felt a kinship, too, with anyone who'd been mistreated. But Norman was not one to remain damaged. He always moved forward, and he usually forgave. Norman had a poster from his textbook publisher in his office, which now hangs over my desk, with a quote by American author X.J. Kennedy. To leap over the wall of self, to look through another's eyes, this is valuable experience which literature offers. This came to mind when I heard Norman in a lecture tell his students that he had dedicated his life to English literature. I thought it quite a narrow or kind of artsy life's purpose until I realized that there's another dimension to literature. It doesn't just teach us about ourselves or our fellow man. It's a backdrop to the history of our times. And as I mentioned before, biography and history complement each other. But biography also amplifies the impact literature has. Holroyd has said biography provided a humanizing effect to history, and this was Norman's view as well. Well, you may wonder how in the world an Englishman ended up working at a small university in America, in Texas. Well, the University of Texas Harry Ransom Research Center bought some of Graham's papers, including over 1,000 love letters to Vivian Dyrrell Browning. And Norman would leave no page unread. Singapore Library flashbacks. The head of the English department at San Antonio's Trinity University cold called Norman at Lancaster University, where he was teaching, seeking a distinguished professor of English literature, conveniently within 1 hour's drive of those archives up the road at Harry Ransom. I joined Norman in San Antonio, an old city, old in American terms anyway, known as the cradle of Texas liberty, with as much history as any town in the United States can claim. On a happy note, San Antonio was one of two cities Graham liked, San Francisco being the other one. And Graham wasn't alone. Mark Twain also said there were four cities in America worth writing about, and San Antonio and San Francisco made his short list too. In a postcard to Vivian, postmarked 1938, from San Antonio, Graham described it as lovely, very hot, palmy, old Spanish cathedrals, river winding in and out of the town, very clean and skyscraping and ancient at the same time. Well, I was surprised that Graham used the word ancient, because even though the Catholic missions appeared in the very early 1700s, I know almost every grocery store in England is older than the Alamo. In 1986, Norman sent me off to track some of San Antonio's places where Graham spoke of in which Graham spoke of in the Lawless Roads on his way to Mexico. He spent a few days in San Antonio waiting for a ride down south. In my investigation, I came across a sweet, tough old man, a former sheriff of Bexar County. He's from an old Texas family. He was a character. He could have been in the movies. And Elton confirmed Norman's suspicion that the west side of town Graham had visited really was still wild and woolly in 1938. When Graham roamed Matamoros Street, he saw the same things that Elton saw when he was sheriff during the 30s and 40s. Elton gave me his book, aptly titled The Wild Dukedom of Bexar County, and another little book, just casually handed it to me, called The Blue Book. Well, it was an index of brothels and ladies of the evening. It predated Graham's visit, but those streets were still where the lonely and desperate gravitated when Graham visited San Antonio. When I got back to the office that day, I transcribed my notes and I gave Norman Elton's hardback book and the little pamphlet without even thinking. I was just doing my job. Didn't even think about it again, but years later, when I was in a bookstore and I opened up volume one, I saw on page 667 the picture of the little blue book, and Elton had written, he had inscribed it to me with my whole name on it. And it was, I wasn't that kind of working girl, so I wasn't real proud of that. Oh, but you might be wondering too how in the world I ended up working for a displaced Englishman. My American literature professor at the San Antonio campus of the University of Texas told me that a faculty member at Trinity was looking for a research assistant and someone to help him with manuscript preparation because he was the authorized biographer of an English writer. Well, my heart was pounding, and I couldn't resist the feeling that something wonderful was about to happen. Oh, that little boy getting a puppy. Excuse me, I'm going to read from my diary. I carry it with me so I have something interesting to read on the train. But I'm going to abridge it, so don't panic. But let's see. I'm sorry, it's a little melodramatic because it's my diary, you know. It's just September 26th, this is when I first met Norman. The stars in my eyes did not occlude my vision. There are a few times in life where I have felt that fate and I collided. I could not deny that it seemed as if destiny were colluding with opportunity. I thought I heard the angels sing. That's really young. I stepped onto Trinity campus. The looming river oaks arched over a Mexican tile fountain towards sloping ivy beds, and a Henry Moore sculpture looked completely natural under a Texas cornflower blue sky and puffy white cotton clouds. It was a really pretty day. I almost skipped along the sidewalk. I felt jazzy, rather syncopated, like Emma Peel on a good spy day. As I walked into his office, a stuffy, musty room, despite the tall, sunny windows on one side, his desk seemed His desk seemed to sink amid bookshelves, chock-a-block spilling over onto the floor with stacks more books. You could trip over books there. If you had something in your hand and you didn't see it, you would knock the books over. And seven legal-sized filing cabinets and a squeaky chair. Norman needed something. I wasn't sure what. It turned out what he needed most was plenty of post-it notes, because we didn't use proofreader's marks. Norman was Edwardian, Victorian. He would leave me post-it notes. And he didn't use dictation. He wrote on file folders. I would find this on my desk in the morning. These would be the changes. Yeah, it was unconventional for sure. Norman needed something, I thought, on that day that I met him. I wasn't sure what. It turned out, oh, I'm sorry. He needed extra fine point pens and cups of Twinings tea, masked just the way his mother made them. Lots of cream and no sugar, but all day long. Once again, I felt that the stars were aligned, but this time they were for me. I found myself at the happy convergence of acolyte and candle, lingering over the wicks he burned at both ends. And with apologies to dear Edna St. Vincis Millay, it was not a lovely light. My final diary entry, before I officially took the job, I said, it could have been daunting, my being one small assistant, walking outside the mid-century red-bricked humanities building in the overall scheme of things, but the overall scheme of things was not my orientation that day. I was not to be distracted by cosmic truths. And like a secret burning hot, I felt a thrill. I was starting a journey of possibilities. And we probably all remember, nothing is as exciting to a young dreamer as possibilities. Completion of Volume 1 was long in coming. In those days, we had to rush the real manuscript in a manuscript box, 1,000 pages worth, to the airport as cargo, when there was no digital way to send it over, and the post office took a month, and the only way was in the hold of a plane. So we did that for Volume 1, and with early floppy disks that held no more than 75 pages, and remember, Norman's first drafts of chapters could be 150 pages. So you were working with 2 or 3 discs per chapter. Anyway, and the dot matrix printer that printed one page in 1 minute. And then you had to burst the perforations from the pages and from the tracks. And then you had to punch them. Oh, anyway, in 1987, things had improved a little bit. We sent the first 20 chapters out right before Christmas break, but we still had to take it ourselves to the Federal Express hub. Federal Express had come into being, which was much more efficient, but they didn't have the same pickup service they have now. I mean, now they'll even come to your house, but there's a FedEx box practically every 10th block. We had to take it to the FedEx hub out at the airport, but at least I wasn't having to go into the airport to the terminal, to a ticket agent, and have her sling it on the baggage belt. So we were making progress, technologically speaking, but Norman was still using a typewriter. The final 22 chapters of Volume 1 were sent out over the next year. Norman took a short break in between Volumes 1 and 2, and for Volume 2, I was there for only the first 6 chapters. We moved away from San Antonio, and 4 years passed before I heard from Norman again. I was working in a different field in a different town, and I thought my editing days were over. But Norman called, and I met him at the airport in Dallas back in the days when you could go to the airport and meet somebody at their gate without a ticket. And I found a very different Norman than I had met in 1986. I remembered that once a friend, a very dear friend, had told Norman that he must have a portrait of himself locked away in a room a la Dorian Gray because he always looked so much younger than he was or even claimed to be. But I chalked it up to a beautiful English-Irish complexion and a happy heart because he did have a happy heart, but no more because the Norman I saw, life had caught up to him, or he had caught up to life, just like it does for the rest of us. And it was dramatic. But I didn't see how I could help him. I lived 300 miles north. I was still in the state of Texas, but I was 300 miles north. But the more I thought of it, the thought of someone else finishing the trilogy, which was exactly what was happening to William Manchester at the time with his Churchill, I just couldn't see that. And so I came along beside Norman just to get him back on track, you know, just to get him started. It lasted for 6 years. He was suffering, and the third volume may as well have been the first, such was his burden. Norman had always worked from chaos to order. He was juggling some crazy things. He was writing and teaching. There we go. He was writing and teaching, which included 6 lectures a week, 20 page term papers per student, 2 per class, per semester, seeing his 2 small children up the road in Austin every weekend, and taking his ex-wife Sylvia, who had come to Texas to live with them because she wasn't doing very well, and then she got sick with breast cancer, and he was taking her to doctors and chemotherapy and writing the biography. He was wearing out. In fact, he was worn out. He could still speak extemporaneously on Democritus and the theory of aesthetics, Dickens, Joyce, and Brontes. He could always hold forth, but he began to lose words or misplace them. And he was misunderstood more and more, and it was painful because sometimes it caused problems at work. But thankfully, I spoke Norman. It was difficult, though, at this point to imagine him traipsing the world in search of green material anymore. And Norman would lament to friends, you know, I'm so disappointed that the BBC has pulled backing for my trip to the Congo, but he was really relieved. He was not up to it. He also dreaded the cuts in Volume 3, as requested by Random House. They wouldn't consider making 2 volumes out of the final one, even though it was twice as long as the second volume, but the paring down of it was excruciating. Norman referred to this uncharacteristically gloomily as killing all my little darlings. This is volume 3, 900 page manuscript. It came from this volume 3, 1200 page manuscript, which came from this manuscript, which was 1935 pages. We began cutting on September 16th, 2001. By the time we finally transmitted the, thankfully, digital version over to Random House, about half the original version was gone. And it still wasn't enough. The publisher cut more. As far as I know, the 24 or so chapters that were cut no longer exist. And this is a tragedy for scholars. But back in his prime, Norman was up for almost anything, anywhere. His past adventures were often sprinkled with instances of comic relief. His good nature allowed him to laugh, which was a really good thing because it was usually at himself. In 2002, despite his difficulties with memory, he went back to Haiti just to polish up some loose ends about Volume 3 and the part about the comedians. He was very careful with this section. He worked on the Haiti section for over a year. These were not chapters emphasizing Graham's fictional Haiti as the setting for comedians, but this was Norman's background setting of the real Haiti that Graham found when he was there that obviously influenced Graham so much. Some of those descriptions that Graham and Norman gave of Haiti were very hard to forget. Norman stayed at the Hotel Olufsen, which was the, he used it for the Hotel Trianon and the comedians. Norman, fittingly, in 2002, stayed in the Graham Greene suite. But 40 years on from Graham's visit there, Norman found the hotel a bit seedy. He arrived exhausted and lay down for a nap. After a while, he heard a buzzing right before he fell off to sleep, and it was growing louder, so he woke himself up, put on his glasses, and followed the undulating line into the bathroom, opened up the cabinet, and saw daylight behind. And in the daylight was the outline of a beehive, and the bees were mad. So he turned and ran into the hallway, coming as close to hollering as a proper English gentleman would, to raise the alarm. But because he was speaking English to customer or clients, guests who spoke mostly French, and because he was trying not to panic, but mostly because he was completely naked, nobody paid any attention to him. In fact, they were afraid of him and they slammed the door. So all I can say is that I'm sure Norman was very glad that there were no cell phone cameras in 2002. But Norman had a knack for getting into jams. But anybody could get into jams in those situations, because Graham went to really dangerous places. He went to villages in the mountains and crossed deserts and hacked his way through jungles. And we all know Graham was seeking danger and excitement to allay his boredom and his depression. And he did these things in order to feel alive. I often tell people Graham had this condition so bad that he went and got a tooth pulled just to feel something. I mean, that's really affecting right there. But because Graham sought distraction by seeking out the depraved human heart and condition all over the world, Norman had been conscripted to do the same. But it was an entirely different experience for Norman, because Norman was as sunny as Graham was grim. And so things were different for Norman on this approach to work. And Norman suffered for his duty. And speaking of Norman's being a good soldier, he was posted to Burma for his military service at the end of World War II, where he was wounded. He was on day watch in a training classroom when in burst gunmen. Norman yelled a warning to his men, and reaching for his sidearm, which lay in front of him, he took a hit to his elbow. But it was kind of complicated. When telling the story, he said the men in his charge had ducked and covered at his command, but he himself was slowed down because he had to reach for his weapon. But he instinctively put the book up, which he was reading, to shield himself. But then he realized he didn't want the book to get hurt. So he shoved the book under the desk and put his elbow up like this to do it, and that's when he was shot in the elbow. I believe the story. I saw the scar, because Norman told the truth. However, the title of the book would change. When he was talking to the Ladies Arts and Letters, it was Palgrave's Treasury of Poetry, I think that's it. But if it was for the men's breakfast at the Air Force Base, it was, you know, Tolstoy or Kafka or some highfalutin Greek or something, you know. But the facts were the same, just the title changed. But Norman didn't ever seem to be afraid of danger, but I wonder if it's because he just wasn't aware of it. His experiences before he went back to Haiti in the 80s and 90s in Africa with corrupt police were really scary, but it shows his naivete. He was told that he was going to have to take some cash with him in order to bribe the corrupt police and the border guards, and he didn't like it, but he was told that's just the way it is, and so he did as he was told. He always did. So upon his first encounter, he pulled out his roll of cash to get by the mean old grouchy border policeman, and he was robbed of all of it. So later, in the same country, in Liberia, now cashless, he tried to talk his way through. Well, this guard wasn't having any of it, and he shot off a rifle right next to Norman's ear just to shut him up. And I kind of know how he felt. And it left Norman's ear bleeding for the rest of that day, and it was ringing for about a year, and it was defective for the rest of his life. So, and he tried it again in Liberia. He doesn't learn. And he got a knife to the throat. So I don't think Norman was aware of danger. Michael Sheldon tells a different version of this story, but I offer the one Norman told in Texas. The facts don't change, just the setting. When Norman went to Mexico to research Graham's journey to write The Power and the Glory, he went to the small village from where that yellow-fanged mestizo might have come. And Norman did actually end up finding him. And Norman was seeking primary sources. That's what Norman did. But it had only been 40 years since Graham had been there, so Norman took out a small advertisement in the local paper promising breakfast to anyone who had any memories of Graham. And Graham was going to stick out in a town like that. He was a tall, quiet, lanky Englishman who was in the periphery observing their life, and Norman thought he had a pretty good chance of somebody remembering. And he was full of optimism. And he went down to the lobby the morning after the ad, the day after the ad had run, and he just had a good feeling. Sources were going to be eager to talk to him. And his heart fairly soared when he walked down into the lobby and he saw some men standing there with their hat in their hand, and they were looking for him, and he thought he's looking for them. This was going to be good. But through Norman's translator, it turned out that they didn't remember Graham. They didn't see him. They didn't know who he's talking about. They just wanted a free breakfast. And so that's what they got. From 1974 to 2002, Norman's first thought every morning was Graham Greene. His dedication was undeniable. And I can't believe that I was there at the beginning and the end. It's still a marvel when I see all three hardback volumes on my table. It represents so much toil, tears, and sweat. By 2002, Norman's teaching and writing life was coming to a close. His final sabbatical offered by Trinity University was awarded so that he could finish writing his own treatise on biography as a genre, or the origins of biography, I mean. His prospectus's opening paragraph referenced a cave in Spain with ancient outlines of several sizes of handprints, children as well, large and small, along the walls. Norman thought of this as the first biography, the first autobiography. They left their mark, and Norman was moved by such deep expression. I believe Norman's work will stand as long as literature lovers seek further knowledge about the writers who write what they love. Three short points, I promise they're short, as I end. The first is a joke, which is really about engineers as a profession, but Norman loved to tell it because it was so antithetical to his theory of communication. It's the story of a man in a hot air balloon, you probably know it, but just imagine Norman in his best, beautiful James Mason pukka accent saying this joke. The balloonist, blown off course on a misty gray day, completely disoriented, to his utter relief, finds himself descending gently amid dispersing clouds along a beautiful grassy coastline. Surely an easy landing, and into his sight comes a woman walking her dog. He shouts down with great excitement, "Ma'am, can you tell me where I am?" You know what's coming, don't you? She says, "You're in a hot air balloon just about to hit the beach." Irrefutable, but useless. That's not how Norman worked. He was never brief, but he was always pertinent. The second reminded me of my first interview with Norman, and it remained a curiosity to me for years. It was his final question to me during the job interview, way back in September of 1986, when he asked me, "Can you keep secrets?" Well, I'd worked for a man of the cloth, and doctors, and lawyers, and therapists, and men who were having affairs. So I answered, "Yes, I can keep a secret." He made me promise, and we shook on it, not unlike the handshake between Graham and Norman that started all this. But I wondered what secrets he wanted me to keep, and I waited for years to figure it out. And I kept waiting. And only after Norman died did I realize that the secrets Norman wanted me to keep were Graham's. Norman never told all he knew. Now, in closing, the Public Broadcasting Service production crew came to Trinity to interview Norman for his Conrad work. They were doing a big series on Conrad. The field producers just invaded his office. They were crawling all over it. They were moving furnitures and tying back the drapes, getting the lights just right for the TV shot, trying to figure out where he was going to be for the camera. And one of the members of the crew said, "How tall is Norman?" Well, after a diplomatic pause, I said, "Not very." And the visiting crew nearly laughed, but they thought better of it. Norman was vain about only one thing. When asked about his height, he would say, "I'm just a little chap with a lot of hair." It was his work he was vain about. But it's true. He stood barely 5'3", but he was 10 feet tall to me.
Well, thank you, Lucinda. That was incredible. The personal way in which you have engaged with the subject matter, Norman. Every creative and critical figure needs a creative and critical friend. And really, I think you all sent, what you have given. And in terms of the lengths that Norman went to, are reflected in the lengths you went to look after Norman, to ensure that his work reached the finished standard it achieved. And I would say there's easily enough work, depth and richness there for a book. I do hope you see that through, because the compassion you show is amazing, and that in itself is a worthy subject matter. So thank you.
I adored him.
And that really shone through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sure there's many questions, and we have plenty of time for questions. Yes. Can I use this? Oh, yeah. Thanks, Mike. Thank you, Mike.
Well, that was a fascinating talk, and thank you very much for all of that amazing and impressive detail to sort of bring it to life. Can I ask a heretical question? You mentioned in one of your slides, I think the first draft of volume 3, I hope this isn't too echoey, was something like 1,935 pages. Now, in terms of biography, would yourself or Norman make a distinction between obsession and illumination?
Well, of course, I would leave that to the biographer himself, but the fact is, Graham was a very busy writer, and Norman didn't really rank his novels as to importance. He treated each novel as worthy of investigation for the biography. So Norman did literary source work, literary detective work on everything Graham wrote. So it's kind of Graham's fault that it was that big. But Norman couldn't cut, and that's why he had me and, oh, I'm sorry, that's why he had me and another very good editor too. Her name was Jeannie. It wasn't just me, but she wasn't around for too long, but she was around to do a lot of cutting as well. But Norman wrote those 1,900 pages thinking that it would be two volumes because he thought Graham's work was worthy of that. And of course, Norman didn't write just Graham's life. He wrote Graham's working life. So there was a lot of material to cover.
Thank you. Yes, Kreiner. Thanks, Mike.
Mike, thank you very much for that. You were so sympathetic and created a lovely picture of Norman Sherry. Can I be clear, after the time then when you were working elsewhere and then you met him again, and he was so changed, Was it the circumstances of his life, or you said he started to forget words and there were misunderstandings? Was this a condition that was identified? What had happened?
Yes, it was. I can say this now because the Guardian outed him, but he was 10 years older than he told people. And plus, it was life. Life was hard on him. He had two children very late in life, and he had two ex-wives who were, he was very sympathetic towards, so he spent an awful lot of time and energy on that. But he also, he liked his wine in the evening, and he drank probably a bottle a night, and he could sustain that until the middle of volume three, I would say. And he was a thirsty fellow, and that was his half Irish side, he would say. So I think it was just old age. I don't think it was ever Alzheimer's. He was just very forgetful. He didn't forget what a chair was, but he forgot how to express. And I'm not sure because I wasn't around, but I suspect that Trinity had asked him to resign because he was a wonderful lecturer. His students adored him, but he wasn't really able to sustain the class load as he aged. So, but he was only retired, I think, for like 5 years, and he was. But I think it was just old age. But I don't think there was anything more than that. But he worked very hard his whole life, and it just caught up with him.
Any more Thank questions? You. Sorry.
Since I've got the microphone, can I ask a question? It's a two-part thing, and it's to do with the dates of publication of Volume 2 and Volume 3. Volume 2 came out in 1994, and I've always assumed that Norman was asked to hurry up because this guy, Michael Sheldon, was about to publish a one-volume thing on Graham Greene in 1994, and could Norman please be in the market for Volume 2 at the same time? Mm-hmm. Hence, perhaps, the quite short nature of the second volume. So part of my question is that true? Am I right in thinking that happened? And then taking it forward 10 years, you talked about Norman Cherry finishing his first draft of Volume 3 in 2001, mm-hmm. and then having this desperate business of editing down. Mm-hmm. Was he given a deadline of 2004 for that process because 2004 was the centenary of Greene's birth and the publishers were saying, we want it for then?
Yes, very, so it's two-part very, very question. Good question, Mike. Yeah, it became 2004 when he missed the 2000 deadline. So they just pushed it up to 2004. He wasn't anywhere near ready in 2000. As far as Michael Sheldon, he was in the picture when I came in 1986. He was already over, you know, Norman was looking over his shoulder at that. And yes, the publisher was very much pressuring him, but you just cannot rush a writer. You just can't do it. So Volume 2 actually was rushed for the very reason you said, but also another distinguished professor at Trinity, someone who has a very dramatic story about surviving the Holocaust. He actually lived the same situation that was in Sophie's Choice. He's a very famous lecturer, wonderful Jewish man, Bill Samuelson. Norman was commiserating with him, and he said, Norman, cut it off at 1955. Just cut it off and send it in. Norman wasn't ready to, but because of what you had said and what his friend Bill said, he just sent it in. That's why it's the shortest. I was there for only the first six chapters, though, so I really don't know that much about Volume 2. But I think your instincts are correct.
Thank you.
Okie dokie. So I think we'll stop there for coffee. We've got half an hour for coffee. Can I thank you again, Lucinda, for coming all the way from Texas? We are the Graham Greene International Festival. So we have we regularly have people here from all over the world, whether it be China, Australia, New Zealand. We have friends here today from the US, Canada, Berlin, Romania. We have friends from all over the UK. David and Alison Jasper come from Glasgow. Do say hello to them, and you will hear David speak later on. Lots of people from Berkhamsted, someone from Helsinki. I think we do pretty well in that regard. Okay, so I will draw things to a close on this session. Do enjoy coffee for half an hour shortly. Browse the bookstores. All of Norman Sherry's volumes are on Richard's bookstore. There's some brand new copies on the Festival bookstore, in the Oxfam shop on the High Street, which has a display in the window full of Graham Greene. There's a signed copy of volume one of Norman Sherry's biography, reasonably priced, I might add. So enjoy. Thank you. Thanks again, Lucinda.